Hello, this is Radio Warnerd, episode 38, and today is Thursday, June 16th, 2016. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, and I'm coming to you from Queens, New York. I'm on the line with the Warnerd, John Dolan, Gary Brecher, as you know him as. And John, how are you and where are you?
We're pretty good. We're back in Phnom Penh because our Thai visa ran out and they don't let you stay. So we've moved back here just in time for the monsoon and had a fun day watching the rain fall down. And we're looking forward to seeing a lot more rain and dodging a lot more motorbikes in Phnom Penh in the coming month.
Excellent. Well, that's exciting. So we are joined by a special guest, our favorite guest. We had him on a couple months ago. He's an expert. Well, he's got a particular and very unique insight, direct and intimate, with Islamic State Western jihadis, Western recruits. His name is Gunnar Hrafn Jonsson. I hope I pronounce it right. And he is with Iceland Public Radio. And welcome back to the show, Gunnar.
Thanks.
And just a quick word to our listeners as well. You know, there were a lot of complaints about the way Zencastr, on the one hand, does good because it makes our voices sound a lot closer and better. On the other hand, anytime we talk over each other, or sometimes it's not even when we're talking over each other, it has to do with their automatic mixing. They sometimes mix our voices so that it sounds like we're talking at the same time, when in fact, sometimes we weren't. So we're going to try and be really good about it and really make sure that we don't interrupt each other. We're going to be like good little students here. And hopefully it'll work this time. So anyway, Gunnar, thanks for joining us. And John, do you want to start off with the questions? I mean, obviously, or the Orlando shooting is, you know, the background to all of this.
Yeah, it's a particularly good time to have Gunnar on the show again, and we're very glad to have him because, as you said, he has a unique history with Islamic State. So Gunnar, maybe you, because we're getting a lot of new listeners and not everybody may have known or watched, sorry, listened when you were on last time, can you tell people again how you started to develop a relationship with Islamic State recruits?
Sure. It was kind of in the early days when they were getting a lot of press after they started to move back into Iraq after they had got some serious recruiting done in Syria. And there was all these news clippings that had like reports from Twitter and other social media. And I decided to, just to try to find these accounts and see if I could trace some of them actually all the way back to someone who was in Syria, some Syrian militants and Iraqis. And eventually I did, and I found some English speakers who were mainly from the West originally. And of course, they were a small fraction of the actual fighting force. But I managed to sort of strike up a relationship with some of them that mostly has deteriorated after Twitter sort of started to enforce their rules against jihadi propaganda more. But, you know, you can still find them on the dark web and you know, Tor network and other places where you can sort of tap them for information once in a while, but it's getting more tricky.
As I recall, some of them were actually giving you tips on how to keep in contact with them after Twitter tightened up its rules.
Yeah, they had some fairly strict protocols, which I'm not sure they all followed, but they had some pretty good encryption, which is literally what it's called, PGP, pretty good privacy. And they used various sort of programs that seemed to be tailor-made by them, probably from some raw code that they stole somewhere. But it was a fairly sophisticated operation. If they wanted to stay hidden, they could. But at the same time, they were posting pictures of themselves and sort of boasting about who they were. So yeah, it was like I told you last time. It was they were very concerned about privacy after they sort of revealed who they were, but they didn't really seem to have much regard for it before.
So when did Twitter start really enforcing, when did you really notice that they were starting to really effectively enforce, you know, keeping a lot of the jihadi Islamic State propaganda off Twitter?
The real watershed was the November attacks in Paris. There was a huge campaign online by Twitter followers trying to oust these accounts, and there was a lot of attention from Anonymous and other sort of cyber vigilantes that were doing the same and reporting these accounts really, really efficiently and finding them quite quickly. So they started to migrate to other platforms. They tried Telegram for a while, as I told you last time. That's sort of been a good way to find them for the past few weeks, but just last week they started to really crack down on them there. So I'm not sure what the future is for them on Telegram there. They seem to adapt pretty quickly.
One more follow-up question. This creates kind of a problem for them, right? Because as you said, on the one hand, they want to be very secretive and protect themselves for obvious security reasons. But on the other hand, their whole appeal has to do with posting videos of themselves and showing off how brutal and scary and fearsome that they are. And so does this seem to be effective? I mean, the way that they're getting driven off social media and out of the public, or at least that part of that world's public eye, is it effective at all, do you think? Is it dampening enthusiasm?
Well, I think the enthusiasm is dampening anyway because they're losing ground. And even their propaganda minister, Adnani, admitted in a speech quite recently that they were losing ground. And he said, even if we lose all our cities and all our ground, we will just go underground again and we will rise again when the time is right. So that's probably some bad news for people who actually moved to the area to be part of an Islamic State that they themselves now say may not be viable in the short term.
Right. Yes, John, do you want to ask?
Yeah, we talked a bit about this last time, that even though going underground might be more effective for them in many ways, it's very important to their idea of a caliphate to exist as a legitimate state. I mean, we talked about something that you and I both observed online when it was easier to find jihadi fans online, that they were, for example, hugely enthusiastic about some gold currency that was going to be the gold coins of the caliphate, and it was going to destroy all the other world currencies which were not legitimate. And it seemed like an absurd project, and it turned out to be a completely absurd project. But it was part of that drive to state legitimacy, which really matters to them. So going underground might be a real blow to morale.
I think so. I think this is a real sign of weakness if they're starting to openly speak about it.
Yeah, and in the U.S., we've been dealing with how to interpret the attacks in Orlando, and I know you know about the attacks, 50 people killed at a gay club in Orlando, Florida, by someone named Omar Mateen, who used his cell phone to pledge his allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi while carrying out the attacks. And part of the problem with this is that U.S. political discourse is so crude and polarized that either you say it's a Muslim thing, or you try desperately to find a way not to make it a Muslim thing. And those are both, you know, kind of simplistic positions. So one of the reactions that you see a lot online right now in the U.S. among more progressive people is that, for example, he wasn't a real Islamic State guy because he praised Hezbollah, a Shia group, which is at war with Islamic State, and therefore he didn't really know his stuff. How do you feel about that?
That was actually one of the most interesting points I heard, because I heard he had claimed that he was connected to a man who had blown himself up with Jabhat al-Nusra and was also claiming allegiance to Hezbollah and or affinity for them, and then ISIS. And it sounds sort of like the old, you know, the guys who bought Jihad for Dummies or Islam for Dummies before they embarked on their mission to Syria. Mm-hmm. And I think it... the larger point is that these guys can claim anything they want, and the lone wolf syndrome has been a subject of much debate in the last few days after this. To what extent do we actually attribute these things to the groups that inspire them, if these people are just watching YouTube videos and they don't have any direct connection to them? And I've seen actually some commentators, even that I have respected in the past, and seen some articles that seem to have completely forgotten the history of jihadism, because they're saying that ISIS is some kind of new appeal to the lone wolf, and this is going to be a wave of attacks, and this is like something we've never seen. But and I even saw people saying that Osama bin Laden would not have allowed this while he was alive. This is all nonsense. This is coming, I understand the sources were from inside Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a very Syrian branch of al-Qaeda and does not represent the old-school al-Qaeda leadership. What's actually coming from, like, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which has been publishing propaganda for a long time, is they encourage lone wolf attacks extremely much. They've been publishing the English language magazine Inspire since 2010, and the very first magazine was dedicated to lone wolf attacks, and they have a running column in the magazine that's called Open Source Jihad and focuses solely on lone wolf attacks. So that's been a central strategy of al-Qaeda for a long time, and I've read some of their really boring theological / warfare handbook texts of jihad, and I found that they actually use this tactic quite openly, and it's been a mainstay of their tactics for 10 years,
Right. Well, I'm old.
Bin Laden's I'm the oldest person theory.
Here, and I remember when Saddam Hussein used or attempted to use the same tactic when he was being bombed by the United States Air Force way back in 1991 in the first Gulf War. Saddam said the Americans are attacking Islamic holy sites, rise up brothers, and strike them in their homelands. The difference is that nothing at all happened, because Saddam Hussein did not make a very good emblem for the Muslim world. I mean, he had a history as a Ba'athist secularist. He'd been exploiting and then dropping Islamic and specifically Arab or specifically Sunni slogans when it suited him. And so nobody did anything. But he certainly saw the power of using there weren't social media so much, but electronic media to try to open source, if you like, these attacks in the homeland of the people who were bombing Iraq. The funny moment in that came when he actually tried to appeal to Iraqi Shia, saying the Americans are bombing holy sites in Karbala and Najaf, which must have led to a lot of rolling of eyes among Shia Iraqi households who'd been getting persecuted by Saddam for decades. But I mean, the tactic is not new, and it's a natural. I mean, any military force is going to use any tech available to try to attack the people who are bombing it, and whatever media you've got, you're going to use them.
Open source jihad, by the way, is a wonderful read. It's pretty wacky at times. They get so desperate They're talking about normal things like car bombs and stuff like that. And then they sort of go, well, if you can't make a car bomb, just tape a bunch of knives to your car and drive into a crowd. And you're like, what?
I saw that in Ben-Hur.
I just had to say, yeah, that's amazing. Open source jihad. I mean, the way that they co-opt even the sort of the hacker language, it's you know, hack the jihad. I mean, it's pretty amazing that they call it that, and that they, you know, it's a way of just rhetorically appealing to young coders and gamers, some of whom I guess make up their recruits.
Exactly. And you should see some of the titles of these articles, like How to Make a Bomb in the Kitchen of Your Mom was a favorite. And then there was the newest one is just about assassinations, just about like killing Warren Buffett and Bill Gates.
Ah, so they're naming targets, I mean, now. How did they come up with Gates and Buffett?
Financial pillars like the Two Towers, and they had a bunch of other targets like politicians and... it's an interesting list, actually.
Yeah.
But not Supreme Court justices. That's odd.
It was a pretty big list.
One thing I wanted to say, getting back to the Nusra connection and this idea that Islamic State stands alone and is something completely different, and they seemed, it's almost like they're kind of whitewashing Nusra a little bit. This may be one of the effects of this strange and really creepy push by a big part of the Washington, D.C., you know, foreign policy brain trust to openly saying that, you know, Nusra, sure, they're al-Qaeda, but what's al-Qaeda anyway? You know, and basically arguing we should ally with them because the FSA, the moderates, have never been that good at fighting, certainly not compared to Nusra. And we can't ally with Islamic State. And Nusra has kind of been the de facto, you know, it's the big open secret. They've been the muscle for the FSA in a lot of areas. Mm-hmm. And so, even David Petraeus wrote an article saying we got to get over our disgust or whatever with al-Qaeda and al-Nusra because they've really kind of changed and these guys are different and Osama's gone and you know, Nusra, they're different guys, they're moderate al-Qaeda or something. So yeah,
what would you think people would have said if you told them in the late 2001 that eventually we were going to have to get over our distrust of al-Qaeda to just sort of win this war?
It's insane. I mean, yeah, no, it's complete insanity. But it's funny, my friend and you know, former exile colleague Yasha Levine went through some old archives and found, he was looking up moderates, and he found where J. Edgar Hoover and Dulles both talked about how this is sort of 5-10 years after the end of World War II, how there are quote moderate Nazis unquote that we can work with. And they were pushing the idea of moderate Nazis, you know. So,
no, it's just a general point. When you find yourself trying to make peace with the better part of al-Qaeda, you know, you've kind of been doing nothing right for the past 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. John, you want to go?
Yeah, I was going to ask. So we're getting all kinds of quibbling in the U.S., some of the U.S. media, about whether this can be this mass murder can be credited, if you like, or blamed, or in any way attributed to Islamic State. So I wanted to ask you, because you're in contact with the Islamic State fighters, how did they react to it?
Well, they all claimed it after Al-Amaq, the news agency, the official news agency of Islamic State, claimed the attack. I think they did that almost purely because the U.S. media reported that he made that 911 call. Almost immediately they reported that. So I'm not sure how much faith we can put in it. I haven't spoken to anyone directly about it simply because I haven't found anyone that seemed to have any idea what they were talking about. They were all just quoting the official statement, which is sort of their... Pravda, you know, they're not going to question anything that comes from Al-Amaq. But, you know, I have my suspicions that he was much further removed from this than he would like to think in his own mind.
Right. Yeah. Did they have any reaction to the attack itself? I mean, were they particularly pleased about this one? Have you seen differences in their reactions to different attacks in the West?
Oh, yeah. They seem to believe this would meet with more general approval in their sort of demographic than maybe some of the other attacks they did. It would be more immediately visceral, the hatred of gays. But there was definitely a lot of that, you know, the brothers and sisters have to wake up and see that these clubs exist. And, you know, and there was even some quotes from some sheikhs in the Middle East that were expressing surprise and disgust that the clubs exist and not really commenting on the actual murders. I'm not sure if those were genuine, though.
Yeah, I've read that when Islamic State instituted the policy of tossing gay men off tall buildings as a particularly dramatic and terrifying form of execution, it was in parts of the territory they rule one of their most popular policies. And I think that's something that people are really, for obvious reasons, are really loath to accept. But I saw this very often in Saudi Arabia. I mean, and it's strange. The hatred of gays coexists with various traditions that might seem connected to male homosexuality, but they're not recognized as such. I mean, the main thing is that you maintain the appearance of public virtue, and a club is a violation of that public virtue, and it made people, the fact that things like that exist made people very angry.
And it's a hugely macho culture, which any kind of femininity is sort of frowned upon in men. So it's I think it's a cultural, visceral reaction more than necessarily anything that's supported by a specific religious text.
Yes, as far as I've been able to see, there's nothing in the Quran that says you kill gay people. There's a rather bland condemnation. Then there's the Hadith, and the Hadith are a little more harsh, and I'm sure there are a lot of pedantic arguments going on now about what should be done. But there's also with any religion, it's constructed at a particular point in history and in a particular place, and that's your religion, even if you think you're doing something that's universal. And for a lot of people in the Islamic State ruled areas, hating and killing gays does seem to be pretty popular.
Yeah, if you remember last time we talked about the burning of the Jordanian pilot in the Islamic State, and how that was controversial because there's a specific hadith, I believe, which bans that, which I think is some kind of ban on Zoroastrianism or something. But
right.
It's interesting how certain things are off limits but not others.
Yeah. For example, we talked about slavery. I mean, slavery in the world in which the Quran was written was a pillar of the economy. I mean, it was the basis of most economies at the time. But when Islamic State revives slavery and uses the scripture to do that, the embarrassing and strange thing is they only seem interested in sexual slavery. And as far as I know, there's been very little interest in just reviving slavery as a production system. Mainly just they want access to infidel women.
Yeah, the men are generally killed.
Yeah. One thing that interested me about this attack is that apparently Omar Mateen scouted another potential location, which was Disney World Orlando. Do you think your contacts in Islamic State would have reacted differently if the attack had taken place there?
That's an interesting question. They probably, I mean, given the same casualties, they probably would have cheered it on in any case. But they seem to have sort of quite a large tolerance for civilian casualties, not just you know, the normal collateral damage, but actually targeting them. So I don't think that really would have changed much. I think they were particularly happy about the gays, though, just on a propaganda level and also on a sort of righteousness level. They can't see anything wrong with it at all.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense in propaganda terms. I mean, you're talking to people who are actually full-time committed fighters, and for them, any infidel killed is good. But they're also dealing with a population that they want to win over, and in that population, attitudes might be a little different. It might be like, well, to be honest, more enthusiasm about killing gays than about killing families at Disney World.
Definitely.
Did any of your contacts quibble at all about his mention of Hezbollah, or did they just ignore that and go to cheering for the attack itself?
You know, I haven't seen any of them mention it. I haven't had any, like I said, I haven't had any one-on-one contact with them in a while, so I didn't ask anyone, but no one brought it up. They were all just quite happy to claim it.
Okay. Yeah. I thought we might talk a little in what time we have
left. I have a question.
Oh, sorry, Mark. Go.
Sorry. I just have a quick question. Gunnar, from your long experience communicating with you know, different types of people from the West who joined up with Islamic State, would you say that Mateen, although, of course, he didn't join them and he just seems to sort of latched on, but would you say he's fairly typical or atypical, or is it too early to tell? What are you able to glean thus far?
Well, I've read a number of profiles, and he seems to be, you know, quite an unstable person, which I guess is common, but often ignored when the people are Muslim, and it's just, you know, okay, he's a Muslim, and it's not examined further. But I think his wife actually just made a huge mistake by sort of admitting that she knew that he was going to do this, but she had said that he was his former wife. Sorry, she had said that he was quite a violent personality, and people have said that he was scary at work. And there was one Icelandic person actually that was in the news because he ran into him just a few days before the shootings, and he was going into a golf club, and he was the security guard there, PGA club, and he looked at his passport and said, "Ah, Iceland." And then he sort of flexed his muscles and went, "Strong man, Iceland." So we had the headline the next day. Mateen was into Icelandic bodybuilders.
Wow. They're talking about that guy in Game of Thrones, right?
Him and we've had several world champions in bodybuilding and strongman competitions for some reason.
Interesting. I know that John also wanted to sort of pull the camera back again a little bit and ask you about what the mood is from what little communications left that you're able to still do with, and what the mood is now that you know, that they're heading more towards defeat. I mean, John, you want to ask the question better?
Yeah. I just thought we'd update you and hear about any changes in what you're getting from these Islamic State guys. I mean, as you said, it's been a rough time for Islamic State. How have they been reacting to that?
Well, my problem is sort of a lack of volume. You know, it's just a decrease of communication, which I suppose is a symptom of them having a hard time of it. There's still some, you know, production being done by the official offices, and you're seeing propaganda videos, but, you know, it's getting harder and harder to actually find the individuals behind the accounts, and they're being more careful and being targeted by drones. And, you know, it's just sort of getting to be quite difficult to assess the situation. But I imagine it's getting quite dire if their propaganda chief is sort of preparing the rank and file for the possibility losing almost all their territory in Iraq and perhaps even Syria.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but that's the part that surprised me. The lines in Iraq have begun to move, and after the disastrous performance of what is loosely called the Iraqi army a couple of years ago, I just assumed Islamic State would hold on to their chunk of Iraq for a good long time, but that has changed. And since their real center of gravity has always been in Iraq, that's a serious matter.
Almost everything they're posting right now has nothing to do with Orlando or anything. It's just Fallujah, Fallujah, Fallujah. And it's, you know, civilians in Fallujah, children in Fallujah, you know, war crimes in Fallujah. And they're the victim in all these reports, more or less.
Yeah, that's a truism of war propaganda. When you're winning, civilian casualties don't matter. But when you're losing, you suddenly stress the civilian casualties as much as you can. So, Gunnar, one question I wanted to ask. Of all the reverses that have struck Islamic State in the past year or so, was there one in particular that seemed to bother your contacts more than others?
That's a good question. I think in general they seem to... No, I'm not sure there was a pattern. They were quite upset about all the losses to the Kurds initially, but that became sort of... an inevitable thing, and you know, as I've said before, I think their main enemy has always been the Shia.
Right.
So I think any concessions they're going to have to make to lose major Sunni cities to the Shia is going to be painful, because that's going to hurt their base, and you know, they're going to get unfortunately probably slaughtered by some of these Shia militias. Right. And that's going to show that they can't protect their base.
Right. In fact, I recently saw a clip from a division of the Iraqi army going into a Sunni village, assembling all the men, and saying, "Who here was with Islamic State?" And it was very rough, but it was... you could see there was some neighborhood revenge being carried out, maybe for very good reason. And three or four men would point at one guy, and he would say, no, I didn't do anything. But eventually a truckload of those who'd been pointed at was assembled and driven off God knows where. And you're going to see that... reenacted. And it's not as if Islamic State hasn't done the same thing in a much more heedless manner, but it's going to be bloody.
I just have one question, one more question, then we're going to have to wrap up. Gunnar, do you have any sense if, because Islamic State doesn't seem to have been the type of group that can survive defeat, unlike a lot of, you know, insurgent groups that we've talked about on this show, do you get the sense that they would move to Jabhat al-Nusra or somewhere else, or just kind of skulk away? What do you think the possibility of that is?
I think they may lose a lot of fighters, but they're not going to be defeated, because they have been defeated before, you know, and they've come back. They've had previous incarnations in the Sarkawi era, and they were almost destroyed in the Sunni revival, or what you call it, and
the awakening.
You know, they're just going to go on underground with their network again, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there is always going to be a Sunni Arab Iraq militant position. I mean, the Sunni Arab faction was Saddam Hussein's faction. They ruled Iraq for a long time. They're used to ruling, and it's ridiculous to think they're just going to disappear. I mean, Islamic State gets their loyalty now, or got their loyalty for a while, because it looked strong. It looked like it was winning, and there hadn't been a lot of victory in recent years. If it stops winning, it will stop gaining much loyalty, but that doesn't mean that that militant Sunni Arab Iraq will vanish. That population will always be there, and it will always have an armed wing.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay, well, at that, I'm going to have to wrap up the interview right now. So thank you again, Gunnar, for coming on our show. It's a huge pleasure to have you on. This is Gunnar Hrafn-Jonsson from Icelandic Public Radio. Thank you for joining us. And John, stick around and we'll do a wrap up.
Yeah, but I have to ask Gunnar one more thing.
Thank you so much.
What did your daughter think of the giraffe?
Okay.
I saw a picture of you at the Berlin Zoo with your daughter.
She was fascinated by the giraffe.
Yeah.
And the monkeys and apes and lions.
Oh, good. Yeah, there's something about seeing a giraffe for the first time that's truly astonishing. Like, shouldn't this thing have gone extinct in the Ice Age? It can't exist.
I actually made contact with a giraffe last time I was in that zoo. I just picked up some grass and held it out, and he came all the way over and ate it out of my hand, which I'm sure is not allowed. But
okay, well, thank you very much for coming on, and we hope we'll be able to have you on the show again.
Thank you.
I'm from Bosnia, take me to America. I really want to see Statue of Liberty. I can no longer wait, take me to United States. Take me to Golden Gate, I will assimilate. Courtyard. I wish to leave this nightmare, go to the promised land. Please take me to your leader, I want my green card. I want to fly over like a rocket from the Balkans. I want to start all over and turn a new page. Forget this dreadful story, escape the Stone Age. Waiting for a chance to get out of the cage. I feel like a slave on a minimum wage. I'm from Bosnia, take me to America. I really want to see Statue of Liberty. I can no longer wait, take me to United States. Take me to Golden Gate, I will assimilate. One day when you reach the end, one day you will understand. One day back to roots, my friend. No place like a motherland. One day when you reach the end, one day you will understand. Now we pushed in a ghetto like a sheep in a herd. All the promises I heard became empty words, completely disconnected from the rest of the world.
But grass is never greener in neighbor's courtyard. I want to start all over, return to no man's land. Send greetings to your leader, don't want your green card. I want to fly back like a rocket to the Balkans.
I'm from Bosnia, take me to America. I really want to see Statue of Liberty. I can no longer wait, take me to United States. Take me to Golden Gate, I will assimilate.
One day when you reach the end, one day you will understand. One day back to roots, my friend. No place like a motherland.
Okay, so that was our interview with Gunnar Hrafn Jónsson of Iceland Public Radio. Another great interview, and thanks again to him. John, what he told you, did anything there particularly stand out as surprising, or did it more confirm some of the things you've deduced yourself? I mean, you just wrote a newsletter, which we'll be sending out tonight, about the Orlando shootings and sort of, you know, other stuff around that.
Right. Well, if I had to pick one of those options, I'd say it more confirmed what I thought. For example, Gunnar, who's a very careful observer, you noticed how he was meticulously avoiding any thing for which he didn't think he had sufficient information. But still, he said Islamic State's official media wasn't concerned with quibbles like the fact that Omar Mateen may have praised Hezbollah, which is, you know, a Shia militia, not a Sunni militia like Islamic State. They didn't care about that. They didn't care about his dubious credentials as an Islamist. I mean, as Gunnar said in a previous interview, a lot of the recruits to Islamic State could probably not pass a quiz in Islamic history or Islamic law or even scripture. But to use that fact, to use the fact that Mateen praised Hezbollah by way of saying that, you know, that this was not related to Islam is a little simplistic. I mean, not everybody in the United States Marine Corps can recite the Constitution either, but there's an overarching ideology there, like American nationalism, that serves very well to motivate them to acts of violence. And that works in terms of Sunni jihadism, too. So there, as I try to explain at length without oversimplifying in this newsletter that we'll be sending out, I understand why people in the U.S. in particular don't want to feed the xenophobic rage of people like Trump, and therefore are saying this was not Islam, this was homophobia, this was not about religion, this was about mental illness, this was not about religion, this was about gun laws. It was about all those things, but it was also about a kind of reactionary Islamism that you see a lot. Listeners who remember our interview with Thierry Marignac, the French novelist, said that a lot of people he knows in France are converting to Islam at the moment. I think the actual words he used were because they want a man to be a man and a woman to be a woman. Now, whether Omar Mateen's grasp of Islam was very good or not, it was the emblem he chose to use. I mean, really, what's going on with Omar Mateen may have a lot more to do with his crazy Pashtun nationalist dad and his own failure to live up to his dad's expectations and the general Pashtun righteous warrior tradition and intolerance for any heterodoxy. But he didn't claim it in the name of Pashtunwali, as it's called. He didn't claim it in the name of the Pashtun way of life. He didn't say, I'm doing this to impress my dad. He said, I'm doing this for Islamic State. And there are a lot of angry young men at the moment using Islam to enact reactionary violence. That's just a fact.
Right. And, you know, the flaw in the argument as well is that for somehow repressed homosexuality, which Mateen may have allegedly been a repressed homosexual, it's one theory, or, you know, mentally ill, or homophobia, that any of these things are somehow mutually exclusive from violent reactionary religious fundamentalism. Yeah. they all go hand in hand, potentially, easily.
Yeah. I mean, these are different ways of explaining the same phenomenon, and they're both very much alive right now. And just to defuse this for a minute, let's take a Christian example. I mean, let's take the New Testament. Saul is on the road. All of a sudden, he has a blinding light, and hears a voice saying, why do you persecute me? There are two competing explanations for that. One is that God performed a miracle to turn Saul from a persecutor of Christians into a Christian recruiter. The other explanation is that Saul had a psychotic break. And which explanation you take depends on a lot of things. But the people who found religions are pretty easy to interpret, if you like, in psychopathological terms. The poets, shamans, and other religious figures who saw possession as the state you needed to have to do your stuff. That's a long-standing phenomenon in human culture. Now, many people in a secular context would interpret that differently, but you can't say there's what we call mental illness over here, and then there's religious devotion over there, because they're competing explanations for roughly the same phenomena.
Exactly. The other thing I thought was a good point he brought up, Gunnar, that, and I think this is happening here too. He said there are commentators, very well-respected ones that he follows, who are saying, well, Islamic State, what they're doing, and by recruiting lone wolves to do this kind of stuff, is something absolutely new and unprecedented, and we've never seen this before, and even Al-Qaeda wouldn't do this. And I mean, Al-Qaeda is slowly being branded as some kind of more intellectual, moderate, you know, jihad movement. And he said, you have to have no understanding of them. I mean, if you read their magazine, they put out started their magazine before Dabiq, before Islamic State started putting out Dabiq. And as he pointed out, you know, its very first issue, it gave instructions on how to be a lone wolf, mass murderer in the West, to fight jihad. So, you know, I thought that was really interesting. We are already forgetting Islamic State is having this interesting effect, which kind of dovetails with a part of the Washington D.C. foreign policy establishment, which is making us forget why we're even fighting in the first place and what happened 15 years ago. It's just it's bizarre.
Yeah, and there are other cases too. I mean, anytime a Middle Eastern leader has been threatened with attack from the West, he's called for lone wolf attacks, or basically any attacks. Sometimes they happen, sometimes they don't. I mean, as I said to Gunnar, I remember Saddam asking for them and not getting them. Gaddafi threatened them, called for them, and occasionally carried them out. I mean, it depends on who you think brought down the plane over Lockerbie, but Gaddafi definitely did manage to have his people put a bomb in a nightclub in Germany and blow up some American soldiers. Lone wolf attacks, or let's just say irregular attacks in the home countries of the people who are bombing you, that's a very old tactic and a natural one.
Right. Hold on one second. I have to dispose of a particular cat who's making some sounds right now. Hold on one second. Mm-hmm. Okay. Cat disposed of. Okay. So, because another thing that did sort of surprise me and raise some questions in my mind is how he said that Twitter and some other social media have been really effective in moving them, in getting Islamic State jihadis off social media. And I found that kind of surprising and interesting because, I mean, it raised a lot of questions. You know, just this last week, this right-wing white nationalist gay activist from Breitbart, Milo something or other, I can't remember his last name, but he's pretty big and he likes making a lot of controversy, and he got kicked off Twitter for, I guess, hate speech or something. And then all of his followers, the Breitbart and Gavin McGinnis, who's one of his buddies, and you know, they made a big stink about free speech, and this is a free speech issue and this is wrong. And then some other people reminded them, free speech only applies to the government. The government can't quash you. I mean, this isn't 100% true, but it's technically true that the First Amendment only applies to the government. And, you know, you have the right on your own property and your own newspaper. You don't have to publish every single person. But this is, I think, a problem with tech's own, you know, propaganda and lobbying efforts and so on its own. I mean, the reality is, if you're banned from a platform like Twitter or Facebook, you do disappear. It has that power.
Right.
I mean, it's like saying railroads have the right to deny service to anybody that they want to because they find them offensive. You know, in the 19th century. Well, then if you couldn't use a railroad in the 19th century, you're massively handicapped.
Yeah.
So it's may not be a government entity, but if you are, it does quash, you know, it does make you disappear. And especially for a group like Islamic State, it can be really deadly because that's how they recruit people, by boasting about how evil they are.
Yeah.
Now that, you know, the tech companies go around and lobby and use the State Department and use the EFF and the other groups to lobby and push different governments around the world not to censor in any way their Twitter or their Facebook, and they call it, you know, an assault on human rights. But now it looks like they're cooperating on something that we find objectionable. And it is objectionable, you know, what Islamic State does and stands for, but it means that, you know, that it is now a global platform promoting American values,
right?
Which is what opponents of, you know, pure free speech for Twitter and Facebook have been kind of arguing. I mean, it raised a lot of other issues because I haven't seen this advertised much. I haven't seen it advertised much that Twitter and Facebook have very effectively shut down the jihadis. And
no,
I have a feeling Facebook and Twitter don't want that advertised.
I think people who've been following this know that it's been harder and harder to post pro-Islamic State stuff as the past 3 years have gone by. It used to be very easy and there were lots of accounts. Now it gets harder and you sort of have to look for code words. But it's true. I have not heard a lot of libertarian protest about that,
or boasting from Silicon Valley either, because I don't think they want it known that they do police heavily for content and make sure that it jibes with American values, Western values, and geopolitical interests.
Yeah, actually, that's interesting in another way, because somehow they managed not to police Omar Mateen's accounts very effectively. I think he was, I mean, I haven't seen his accounts, but I gather he was posting pretty openly pro jihad stuff.
Well, what I read from, here's an article from Fox, I think from the Fox affiliate down in Orlando, was that he was posting Facebook posts from within the club. This is actually another thing. I've seen this with, well, I think this may have happened in San Bernardino, and it's happened with some of the rage workplace shootings, a couple of them. This one in Virginia where a fired African-American who was fired from, I think, a TV station work when he killed this woman and the cameraman. You know, he was posting stuff on Facebook before he got killed.
Right.
So this Mateen from inside the club, after he started shooting, he was posting and then searching and searching for all the links to people talking about what he was doing. And here are some of the posts. I'll read them to you, because this also segues back to what we were just talking about, which is, to what degree is the Islamic State or not? So he posted, I pledge my allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. May Allah accept me. The real Muslims will never accept the filthy ways of the West. You kill innocent women and children by doing us airstrikes. Now taste the Islamic State vengeance. Another one, America and Russia, stop bombing the Islamic State. And then in his final post, he said, in the next few days, you will see attacks from the Islamic State in the USA.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting series of posts. I mean, one of the things that you can't help noticing is the incredible petty vanity of somebody who is going around putting a headshot into all the bodies on the floor, and yet is still concerned to check on how his big moment is being reported. I mean, that really is astonishing. I mean, he's checking to see that he's getting coverage. And then when you look at the order of those things, I'm assuming they're being reported in the order that he made them. It's kind of interesting. First, he pledges allegiance to the leader of Islamic State. Then he says, the real Muslims will never accept the filthy ways of the West. Then he says, you kill innocent women and children in airstrikes. I mean, the first two are about his allegiance and presumably why he targeted a gay club. And then after that, there's a sort of appeal to something that's more likely to work on a liberal Western audience, which is, and actually it's about the airstrikes. But that's not the content of the first things he said.
Yeah, there are a few things that were kind of surprising. I mean, again, there are a lot of people who, for very understandable reasons, want to believe or hope that he's just a complete loon, incoherent loon, and some of that evidence being that he claimed to be with Hezbollah and Nusra and Islamic State. But in any event, I saw one story where an African-American in the club who was in the bathroom, you know, some people were hiding in a bathroom, and they would sort of pull their legs up and sit on the toilets terrified, and he would walk around in there. And he asked, according to the African-American guy, Mateen asked, are there any black people in here? And this guy answered, I am. And he said, it's okay, don't worry, I'm not going to hurt you. You guys have suffered enough.
Yeah. It's interesting because 90% of the dead were Hispanic. I suppose half Puerto Rican, other nationalities or ethnic origins for the others. But I suppose he didn't have much of a sense of Hispanic heritage.
Yeah. Somebody else brought that up. I wonder why. I mean, well, because some of the reports from his colleagues where he worked as a security guard, and that's another issue, he worked at G4S, talked about how much of a racist and anti-Semite and violent, boastful, wannabe jihadi he was, and reported him. So it was just kind of surprising that he had that particular view on African-Americans. Then there's the question, of course. Go ahead.
You're dealing with somebody in the last moments of a very vain young male gesture, which almost incidentally involves killing 50 people, but is mainly about his ego, as you can see from the fact that he was searching. He was doing searches for Pulse Orlando and shooting to see if he was getting attention, and the sudden interest in African American rights at the last moment is seems like another grand gesture. I mean, Samuel Johnson said something like to the effect that, you know, deathbed statements are the least likely to be honest of any of all, because, you know, they're grand final gestures. And this, that seems like a final gesture by a sentimental bully, which is how anyone who knew him has described him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So then that brings us to the issue of that he worked for G4S as a security guard. I mean, the whole security guard industry, you know, has really exploded since the 70s. And this is a company, it's, I mean, I was reading a bit about it. It's British based, but its American affiliate or subsidiary apparently came from Wackenhut. Wackenhut, which does a lot of, well, I guess there's no Wackenhut anymore, but it was a private security company set up in the 50s by ex-FBI people and CIA people. And it's always had, you know, it's been hired to secure all kinds of, you know, military bases and embassies and Saudi oil fields and so on. And they've always had a lot of, you know, scrubs and just your usual kind of bodyguard. Security guard type, but then it would also have, you know, at the higher levels, I think, former spooks, former FBI people. So there's that issue. And he sounds like a guy who wanted to be a cop.
Yep.
Which isn't usually surprising. I mean, hell, a lot of serial killers want to be cops. I mean, I remember reading about when they came up with the original profiles for serial killers. One of the standard things about serial killers is that they drive one of two cars, either a VW, usually a VW bus, or a bug, but usually a bus. Or the other car was a former cop car that they, you know, sell off. So they, a lot of these guys, like the Atlanta, the one who killed all the black kids in the late 70s, early 80s, he had a fake cop car. A lot of these guys have fake cop cars.
Yeah.
So I don't find that, you know, and what is their job? I mean,
yeah.
It's a violent job around a bunch of violent people.
Yeah, you're at the low end of the enforcer business. I mean, why is there a movie called Paul Blart Mall Cop? Because, I mean, security guards are understood as people who are trying to be macho but somehow fail to make the big leagues and are somehow ludicrous versions of that. I mean, and I say that, by the way, as someone who was a security guard. Come to think of it, and drove a former cop car. Hey, they were cheap. They were selling those ex-cop Plymouths for $500 each. So sue me.
All right, where are the bodies buried?
Yeah, here and there. You move around, you forget. But, I mean, yeah, I would not be surprised to hear that some of my former colleagues were involved in something like that. They were pretty messed up people. And yeah, it's that the enforcer profession is probably full of messed up people no matter how high you go. But as you go higher, you found people who have been able to keep it together on the surface. And as you go lower, down toward the security guard, you've got people who are understood to be a parody of machismo in popular American culture. I mean, I'm just thinking of another security guard parody. There's a movie called Gross Point Blank about John Cusack playing a really cool high-end assassin, and the clear reason Minnie Driver eventually ends up with him is that she knows he's killed hundreds of people, and even though she objects on the surface, she thinks that's really cool. But his sidekick, or one of his ex-high school friends whom you meet in the movie, is this local security guard who's always pulling out his gun at inappropriate moments and is like a head shorter than Cusack and bald and generally meant to be a joke. So the whole security guard thing is a little chamber of rage, because you're full of these ideas that are idiotic and violent in the first place. And you also know that you're the lowest representative of those ideas.
Right. And so some of the other things surprised me. So G4S, is either the first or second largest private employer in the world, 625,000 people.
Wow.
It's a kind of like conglomerate of private security firms. That just tells you what, you know, what the world is like too.
Well, we met a GeForce S employee today at a bank. I mean, I noticed that emblem because you've talked about this company before, and I've become sensitized to it. And there's a guard by the ATM with a handgun and a G4S badge on his arm.
Right. They also, they've been given contracts to run Guantanamo, where all kind of torture is going on. They've been involved in a lot of scandals in Florida, abuse of, I think they operate security in several prisons, including juvenile detention centers. And in fact, Mateen, I think, worked as a security guard in one of these juvenile detention centers. And I mean, there've been huge scandals and they also run, I think, refugee detention centers for Australia, when they take the people who arrive, basically who aren't white, and put them in detention camps in Papua New Guinea. G4S is involved in that. And that's also been full of all kinds of scandals. One can imagine. I mean, they'll get a contract from the government, and their interest is to make a profit. So what they're going to try and do is have as few people as possible, guarding as many people as possible. And when you get that situation, of course, you know, you're going to get more violence and more violent people guarding.
Yeah, you're going to need people who want some contact, who are, enthusiasts for violence, because it's going to happen if you have that kind of small numbers.
So the other thing that there are a lot of strange things too. I mean, so he works as a security guard with this large global security company, which, you know, has both the lower end stuff and then high end, high security jobs as well. Then you have the fact that when the Nusra recruit from Florida blew himself up in Syria, and I don't have his name on me but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it was from Fort Pierce, which is in the same area.
Right, exactly. It's from the same area, and it turns out they had some contact, and I think Mateen may have gone to the same mosque. They had some contact. So the FBI investigates, and they open up an investigation. They find out from everybody he knows that all he does is talk about jihad and killing Westerners, and is boasting left and right. And then they close the investigation. Yeah. I mean, one bell that rings in my head, alarm bell, is they either want to start tracking the guy after that. I mean, I'm skeptical that they completely walked away from him at that point. Maybe they did. Maybe they don't have the resources. Maybe they also tried to turn him into an informant. Maybe they decided just to watch him as a honey trap, as an unwitting honey trap. But you know, there's going to be a lot of questions about what went on, how the police conducted themselves.
Well, especially when you factor
especially
when you factor in, the fact that this guy has a very strange father who has friends in DC, those friends in D.C. have a long connection of dealing with hardcore Pashtun nationalists like this guy's father. And they saw them, until very recently, as friends of the U.S. because they killed Russians. And who knows if this guy's very strange father had something to do with this as well.
Or had something to do, both with inculcating his son with this messianic, idiotic messianic ideas. His father sounds like a loon, and maybe even getting him out of trouble all the time. I mean, his father, it is a little odd that his father is involved in a propaganda TV station, that his father was able to interview the president of Afghanistan. It's odd, and one explanation could be that it's just a small community, Afghan refugees inside of America. But I like one of the things one of your commenters said on the Warnerd Facebook page. Where do I have that? Anyway, he said something to the effect of, he reminds me of a very typical sort of emigre type, like Iranian emigres and Cuban emigres, where they have this kind of messianic complex that they're going to lead the revolution, and they, only they, can be the ones that are going to free their country from, you know, whatever horrible leader is leading them at the moment. He said,
yeah, I think that was Mateo
not
Pechos.
Uncommon in
yeah,
certain
I think that was Mateo Pechos who said that.
Yes.
And yeah, it's a really good comment. He has a lot of really good comments, and it certainly fits Martin's father, who made videos of himself in military uniforms he wasn't entitled to wear, did a video apparently of him ceremonially arresting all the current leaders of Afghanistan and others like Zalmay Khalilzad, who's a Pashtun-American military figure. I mean, the guy clearly had delusions of grandeur. And his first comment when his son was arrested is, oh, well, he saw two men kissing in public in Florida, and that set him off, which clearly implies a lot about how hardcore patriarchs like this guy think. I mean, Pashtun culture is not unaware, let's say, of male homosexuality. There are a lot of jokes about that in Afghanistan. I mean, they have a term for boy play. And if you remember the human terrain system, there was an interview given by Dr. Montgomery McFate, where she famously said, when asked for an example of what the human terrain system can do, oh, well, the army was trying to stop these Pashtun men from raping boys, basically. And we told them, don't interfere. That's part of their culture. So it's not homosexuality in itself that's offensive. It's the idea of two men kissing each other. That is, two adult homosexuals engaging in consensual behavior, as opposed to the old Greco-Roman idea of an adult male having all the power and using it sexually against a boy. That doesn't offend their sense of patriarchal value at all. But the two men kissing in public, that would be very offensive. I mean, and that was the father's first reaction before he had time to scrub his comments. So you can assume some of those attitudes got passed on to his son.
And then to I don't know, to dip down in another weirder level, I mean, so one of the main DC politicians that that he spent time with and had meetings with was Dana Rohrabacher, the very weird Orange County Republican congressman. You know, very right wing, very anti-communist. He used to boast about, you know, fighting with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to kill communists in the 80s when he was working for Reagan. Then he became his own congressman in his own right. You know, he has, well, he's boasted of it, and it's pretty clear he's his old CIA ties going back to his student days when he would go around sort of with these student organizations trying to rally anti-communists, students in different countries like in Southeast Asia in the late 60s. And he was in Prague right when the spring, during the Prague Spring, and right when the Soviet tanks entered. So he gets around, and it turns out, it's such a weird story, because I you know, finally I have a reason to tell it. So it turns out that in 2007, so this is the guy that Mateen's father would meet with.
Yeah, Dana Mateen's father has been photographed with.
In 2007.
We need to tell people, Mateen's father has been photographed with Dana Rohrabacher, and Rohrabacher admitted meeting with him.
Right. So 2007, Rohrabacher, it was reported in the press in Southern California that he had dressed up in drag in order to fool Sirhan Sirhan into letting him visit, into letting Dana Rohrabacher visit him. And Rohrabacher then badgered him and, you know, wanted to try to force him to admit that he was part of a plot by Arab extremists, actually, you know, and that he killed Robert Kennedy on behalf of some larger Arab conspiracy. So you have a congressman who dressed up in drag. It's such a weird story. So I want to read a little part from the OC.
No, that is just one of the most stunning stories I ever heard. That, why the drag, for one thing? I don't quite get it.
So let me read some parts of the story from the OC Weekly, the Orange County Weekly, which then covered it more and followed up on this story. First of all, Rohrabacher, it turns out, says that he was in the Ambassador Hotel that night, and he was right next to the pantry where Kennedy was killed. And he said that's the reason why he wants to solve this, and he wants Sirhan Sirhan to admit it, which is already even triply weird. What the hell was he doing?
He's a lifelong Republican.
He was a far right wing. Yes. Also very close. He was one of the first politicians that the Kochs put their money into in the early 70s, but that's another story. So here's what he said. He was at the Ambassador Hotel, and he said, while I was walking into that party, somebody ran past me and bounced off me. The guy was wrestled to the floor in front of me by either security guards or police, or he's hauled right in front of me. The guy looked exactly like Sirhan Sirhan, a young Arab-looking guy. Was the guy I saw Sirhan or somebody else? Either way, that's a big deal. So I've studied some of this stuff and all my various researching, especially for the Deke story. There was a guy who was detained that night. He did kind of look like Sirhan Sirhan. It's kind of weird, but he's Israeli. Mm. It turned out I could go back to my notes and find his name and the photo of him. I'll send it to you after the show. He was actually Israeli. But Rohrabacher thinks this proves some Arab conspiracy. He said, either way, that's a big deal because nowhere does it ever mention another Arab being there that night. Well, I'm sorry to say, you know, a lot of Israelis look like Arabs. I mean, we don't want to talk about that, but that's how it is. And then, so it says here in early 2007, Rohrabacher decided to solve his murder mystery for the Kennedy family. At some point, Sirhan sent Summer Reese, one of his lawyers, a letter telling her that, quote, a Diana was coming to see him. The lawyer then told the journalist, Sirhan didn't know it was the congressman because his visitor was presented as a woman. Rohrabacher, undercover, in drag, using the name Diana.
I wish there were photos.
I know. They did their own Photoshop at the OC Weekly, but he writes here, perhaps this sheds light on why ex-Congressman Bob Dornan liked to call Rohrabacher, quote, a fruitcake. And if you have Dornan calling you a fruitcake, you got
problems. That was the guy known as B1 Bob.
Continuing on, so the OC Weekly guy then followed this up and with Rohrabacher, and he said, I went to see Sirhan specifically because I believe he didn't act alone and that the full story of Bobby Kennedy's assassination has not been known. I would like Sirhan Sirhan to finally, at long last, level with the Kennedy family and the American people, whether to clear his soul as part of his Christian beliefs or to try to set the record straight. But the congressman... I'm sorry, the lawyer told the Pasadena Weekly that once Diana Rohrabacher got face to face with Sirhan, Rohrabacher, quote, repeatedly badgered him to admit he did the killing. And as he asked, but Diana, Dana, why did you need him to admit to a crime he'd been convicted of 4 decades ago? Wow.
Did Rohrabacher ever answer that?
And then the answer here, and this gets, well, so no, but the answer that the OC Weekly writer says is an answer might be found in this fact. In the 1990s, Rohrabacher was the lone congressman to shill for the Taliban, claiming that the, quote, liberal media, unquote, had unfairly portrayed the group as anti-woman and uncivilized while they harbored Osama bin Laden. And that presumably, you know, he's trying to get people to forget that. I think he's just pretty loony, but the Taliban stuff does explain better how he would wind up palling with Mateen's father.
Who has praised the Taliban and who is a hardcore traditionalist Pashtun nationalist.
Right. So that's that weird story. I think that's enough weird to not get too far off topic, you know.
Yeah,
enough weird for the Mateen story.
I mean, the more you find out about the people who actually rule our country, the more stunned you are. I mean, that I knew Dana Rohrabacher was kind of a right-wing loon, but really, I had no idea.
I don't think anybody, I mean, that's too loony to, you know, that just would break brains if that was put on CNN. They just, you know what, let's just kill that story and pretend it never happened, yeah. Folks, okay? You know, get the Men in Black memory zapper out and just zap everybody and move on with your life. Okay. So moving on from that story, I mean, I think one thing we can be sure of, and I know this from studying rage massacres and the initial reports and the portraits that are drawn initially, and then what you get over time. And you've seen this, I'm sure, from different, you know, jihad attacks, terrorist attacks, and so on. I mean, there's going to be a lot that's going to change, probably. That we're going to learn a lot of new things, and some of them are going to be, they're going to upset the kind of the initial simplistic narratives that we've been trying to build. And I would imagine one of the things we're going to find out is that things did not go well with the police. Right. I mean, this is for something else. I was actually talking a bit to Max Blumenthal about this yesterday, but, you know, first of all, it took them 3 hours, between the time that he was shooting and the time. And you say, okay, well, he took hostages. Well, according to some hostages, certainly one hostage I read, the police did have a shootout with him and failed and pulled back fairly early on. And then that big hole in the bathroom, you know, they put bombs there to blow a hole and it didn't work. So then they brought in an armored vehicle. Yeah. And the question comes up, and I've seen this, you know, in raid shootings when it's thought that there might be hostages or there have been. I mean, it's very possible, let's say, that some of these people may have been killed by friendly fire, or that they may have been much more rescuable and weren't rescued when they could have survived.
It's extremely hard to kill that's 50 upset. People. Extremely hard. I mean, even with the best assault weapons you can get. This guy had time to go around putting a Russian assassin would call a control shot into the head of people who'd already been shot and were lying on the floor. He had time to check how he was being covered on Facebook. He had time to send out all kinds of messages on social media, to make speeches to the people, some of whom he was about to kill. It seems very clear that there
phone calls
there were that the police did a pretty lousy job. I mean, I suppose you can say this wasn't your ordinary police operation, but certainly police in America have made a big deal out of their militarization. And if you're going to militarize, at least be good at it, and at least, you know, do something when you have what amounts to a military operation on your hands.
Yeah, no, I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, sure, it's not a standard operation, but our police, down to even like small towns, are so militarized, and they got all kinds of military equipment, especially in the 90s, and I think again the 2000s, another wave of it. You know, and people have been talking about how overly militarized they are. Well, I guess that's only really good for using ridiculous, overwhelming power on peaceful protesters, but not much good when going against an actual lone gunman, which is raises a whole not you know whole
well,
set
well,
of more questions there.
That seems to, but that seems to obsess the police was quote the device. There's an obsession among both wannabe jihadis and law enforcement with bombs, when, as I guess is pretty obvious by now, in a country where you can get effective firearms as easily as the U.S., bombs are a stupid idea. You can kill people just by shooting them. And yet, if the cops were hesitant, and it seems they were, it might have been because they were worried about this device, which, whatever it was, came to nothing. And meanwhile, a lot of people were being killed with ordinary bullets. which aren't fetishized by the movies and law enforcement and jihadis the way bombs are.
Yeah. And it turns out the only bomb that went off was the police bomb, and that also didn't seem to work, although there's a question about it was a big bomb or a set of bombs. I don't know exactly what the explosives were that they used, but there's been talk that maybe that bomb may have killed some people in the bathroom. I mean, we don't know. And among other things, I know some journalists, actually, I think Blumenthal's group under Alternate, they've been trying to FOIA the 911 calls. He made 10 to 12 calls between, you know, in those 3 hours to rant and to say why he was doing this, and also to talk about, to claim, I think, that he had snipers on the roofs and other boasts. But they won't release it, and there may be other reasons. I mean, you do have to ask why. Yeah. Usually secrecy, more cases than not, is used to cover up screw-ups than it is to cover up for our benefit. Usually that's how it works.
Yeah, but it was obviously a fiasco, and a very strange fiasco. And those are the hardest to take apart, because you don't know what part of the strangeness matters, if anything at all. I mean, you were saying that
right.
In the case of the Tsarnaev brothers, for example, who did manage to detonate a bomb, although it didn't cause the kind of casualties that we saw in Florida. In the case of the Tsarnaevs, there are a lot of really weird connections, and I think you've looked into them, right? But what you finally came up with is it's just hard to say, because it's such a small community, the whole Chechen American group, that it's hard to say if their connection with certain intelligence people was significant or just a matter of numbers.
Yeah, so it turns out that Jakar Tsarnaev, his high school, when he was in high school, he did a project on Chechnya history. So he left when he was pretty young. He got out. His family left Dagestan. They're originally Chechens from Kyrgyzstan is where he grew up. But he left Dagestan, which is a neighboring republic of Chechnya within the Russian Federation, moved to America. So he was a lot more Americanized than his older brother. And in any event, his project manager for this high school project was a professor from University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, named Brian Glenn Williams. And I'd seen a story, and I wrote this up, and from the New Bedford Standard Times, a local paper, where Brian Glenn Williams he was visited by the FBI almost immediately after the bombings, and he actually asked or said, quote, "I hope I didn't contribute to it." And it turns out that Brian Glenn Williams is a CIA guy, and that his specialty, and his specialty for the CIA, and he was open about it, his specialty for the CIA was studying jihadi groups in Afghanistan, jihadi groups, and even more specifically suicide bombers in Afghanistan and Chechnya. And he's written several articles about Afghanistan and Chechnya. He's very much, and he's with the Jamestown Foundation, you know, that old spooky Bill Casey outfit, which actually does have a lot of good, you know, useful research and articles, but also has an agenda, put it mildly. And so here you have, you know, this guy who wound up being a jihadi suicide bomber, whose high school mentor was a CIA guy who kind of may have helped radicalize him, because he's the one that kind of taught Jakar, at least he thought so, a version of Chechen history that would make you angry about Russia. And then the other kind of strange thing. So when I published this, he wrote a really long, angry, confused letter denouncing the idea that he had anything to do with it, even though he already was quoted in the media,
it's not
investigated by the FBI.
If your first comment was, "Uh-oh, I wonder if I did it."
Exactly. The other strange thing is that their uncle-in-law, was a big time CIA officer named Graham Fuller. Graham Fuller was the top CIA guy, the number one and number two guy in the Kabul embassy in 78-79 when Zbigniew Brzezinski hatched that plot to draw in the Russians. And he eventually was kind of brought down in the late 80s to the in the Iran-Contra scandal. He's a very big deal, this guy. And this is their uncle. It's their uncle's first wife's father is how it was. So you know, there's certainly a lot there for conspiracy theorists to, you know, to choke on. But I feel like having looked into it a lot, I mean, the most likely conspiracy, if there is one, is that these guys were being recruited. Or certainly the older brother was being recruited, whether or not he actually was or not. It's an open question, but that's often what it's all really kind of hiding. There are very few Chechen refugees.
It's a small group in the first place, but there is a link between Martin's Pashtun nationalist father, who broadcasts in Dari rather than Pashto for some reason that I don't really understand. There is a link between his context for coming to America and being welcomed to America when much stricter vetting was applied to people from other countries, and the way that the Tsarnaevs were accepted, because very simply and very obviously, without any conspiracy theories at all, Chechens and Pashtun were both fighting Russians. And that was seen as a big part of what made you a good candidate for our side. And if there was any sloppiness about handling them, it probably comes from some prejudice as simple as that.
Right. I want to close off this part about the Tsarnaev story with how this ended up in publicly. So just before I published this story in BuzzFeed, Ben Smith, who's the editor of BuzzFeed, published a story arguing a crazy theory, which is that when the older Tsarnaev went to Dagestan and Chechnya for a year, about, you know, in the last month before he came back and then did the Boston Marathon bombing, Ben Smith and BuzzFeed said it's very likely that the Russians somehow programmed him when he was out there and turned him into an anti-American suicide bomber without his really knowing it, and then set him back here like a program mentoring candidate.
I actually
I'm not
saw
joking.
That in
Naked Gun. And it, I mean, God.
Remember? Pop Schmier programs his secretary to become a killer without even knowing it.
So I think this is Pop Schmiernov who did this to Tsarnaev. So Ben Smith published that and said, you know, conspiracies, of course, don't happen in America, but they do happen with Russians. And then my story came out where I actually cited facts and factual stuff. But then I even pulled back and said, look, this doesn't mean there was some wild conspiracy. I was very clear because I knew that people would freak out. And, you know, emotions are very high in the immediate days afterwards. And Alex Jones is always there to, you know, crap on the narrative. But it's an interesting and from any journalistic, from any way you look at it, any journalist should jump all over that. What the hell is this Boston Marathon bomber doing with his high school mentor was a CIA officer who specialized in suicide bombs in Chechnya. So anyway, I published my story and Ben Smith went public. I'd never had any real interaction with him before. Started going around Twitter and the internet saying Mark Ames is a conspiracy theorist. This is a conspiracy theory. Any other journalists who started sort of pushing the story out saying, wow, this is wild. He would personally go to them and say, don't read it. It's a conspiracy theory. And that's when our problems with Ben Smith began. And that's another story, but he wound up regretting it. Right. So
and his theory was it couldn't be a conspiracy theory. Couldn't be a conspiracy story because it happened in America and they only happen in Russia. Okay.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, it's really that, even though I actually didn't weave and say this proves the CIA is behind it. God only knows why. All I know is after that, we sent one of our, this is when I was at NSFW Corp, we sent Chris, who's sort of our main fixer, we sent him to a big BuzzFeed event that was co-sponsored by the Koch brothers. 2 days later, we flew him out. And then Chris walked right up to Ben and said, "Hey, Mark Ames says hi." And, you know, really liked your Koch brothers event. And Chris said that Ben just shook his head and just said, "Tell Mark I was a big fan of the Exile."
Wow.
And then Yasha came out with a story. Yeah, and Yasha, we did a deep dive and just uncovered all of these Koch brothers sponsorships, hidden sponsorships, and how it affected the, you know, the actual reporting without disclosing the conflicts of interest. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, why fuck with it? Go after me when I'm screwing up. Yeah. You know, when I actually do something wrong, and that's, then I have to bury my head in shame.
Yeah.
But don't do that.
That is amazing. Wow. And the strange thing that I remember from Exile days is that people often announce that they had always been big Exile fans right about the time they thought they might be Exile targets.
Yes. But you know, the crime was already committed. I don't know. I mean, yeah, they do usually. And I think you kind of thought, well, the Exile's gone. I mean, that was a nice thing about NSFW Corp to a certain degree. It was somewhat insulated. It's just that it had a very, you know, it was like a Nexus 6. It just had a short lifespan, but what a lifespan it was. All right. So let's move on to a few other stories from the world of wars. Get away from jihad and Orlando and Islamic State. One story that can, this isn't necessarily war, but it does, it's about Cambodian Empire. They use some kind of laser airborne technology to discover that underneath Angkor Wat, there was this massive urbanized city 1400 years ago, or complex of cities in Cambodia that would have made it the largest and most sort of technologically advanced urban center in the entire world.
Yeah, I think it was a little, it was later than that, though. I think it was the 12th century. But yeah, that was.
Well, I'm sorry. You're right. Multiple cities between 900 and 1400 years ago. Right. Yeah, okay. So yeah, you're right.
This has a lot to do with the Khmer Rouge, as we talked about when we were discussing how the Khmer Rouge emerged and why they were so crazy. And actually, I think this is one of the things that Philip Short's book on Pol Pot doesn't really stress enough, because you see it here all the time. I mean, Cambodia was once a great empire. I mean, the Khmer Empire at its, I mean, it began around the time that Charlemagne was crowned, almost the same time, right around 800 AD. And it ended very suddenly around 1430 AD. But in the time between those, its beginning and end, it controlled almost all of Southeast Asia. And the Cambodians, the Khmer, were the dominant group. They ran the place. And like a lot of once great peoples, they will always remember that, and they can never quite get over it. And a lot of people thought they were maybe exaggerating this, but at least it turns out that they were mourning and having weird reactions to a genuine past greatness. I mean, apparently this city was the biggest pre-industrial city in the world, which is astonishing. Bigger than anything in China, bigger than anything in India. That's amazing. And the Khmer had restricted the Cham to roughly the Vietnamese coast, and owned everything from the Vietnamese coast to most of what's now Myanmar. And this wounded nationalism is a big part, a lot of the time, of the craziest nationalist movements. I mean, in a way, it was a big part of the Third Reich. It was a big part of the Khmer Rouge. And the interesting thing is, I've talked to people who've lived here a while, and they say even now in Cambodia, the whole reaction to being liberated by the Vietnamese army is very schizophrenic, especially here in Phnom Penh, because I talked to somebody who'd been tossed out of a bar for mentioning Vietnam without condemning it, mentioning it in a neutral way. You can't do that in Phnom Penh. Vietnam is still the enemy here. But that's at street level. When you drive through the streets, what you see, and I actually saw this today, is a giant banner saying in English, "Long live the friendship between the Cambodian and Vietnamese peoples." But that's not what you hear, apparently, when you hang around bars talking to Cambodians. You hear the Vietnamese are domineering aliens and we hate them. But the funny thing is that people say when you go up to the north of Cambodia, to where to Siem Reap, where Angkor Wat is, or where it's near, they laugh at that kind of thing, and they say that's just those southerners trying to get over their embarrassment at being liberated by the Vietnamese. We knew the Khmer Rouge here. This is where they sent a lot of their exiled city dwellers to work them to death and then, or beat them to death with clubs or hoes. And all those Khmer Rouge guys ended up stealing all the statues they could. You'll notice, somebody was being told, you'll notice all the restaurants in town here have some of those really good-looking statues from the ruins, but you'll notice the museum here has only a few statues. That's because the local Khmer Rouge commanders took all the statues and then, you know, in a very familiar way to you, having lived through the transformation of the Soviet Union, they switched from being fanatical communists to being fanatical capitalists and used those statues to draw customers to the restaurants they started.
Yeah, that's it's a familiar story, and it's a pretty horrible story too. It's depressing. So, but the point being that the memory of and the wound of that lost empire, you know, it informs a lot of the, especially the crazier politics of, you know, of our modern times. And I think Korea also was a big, powerful empire up through about the 16th or 17th century.
Yeah. I don't know
if I remember. I'd have to look into that more.
There is definitely a Korean tradition that we were great once and we will be great again. And if you have that tradition and you think mm-hmm. it resides in the folk, the people, a lot of things that the Khmer Rouge did that made no pragmatic sense start to be easier to understand. Like, if you think your people are like incarnate seeds of greatness, why not send them back out and have them farm the way they farmed when the Khmer Empire was great? Maybe you could actually imagine that resuming that way of life would somehow bring back the empire. Of course, it didn't. It just killed a horrendous number of people. But these dreams of past greatness are very toxic things.
So moving on to Eritrea and Ethiopia, because funny, right after our last show, and after we talked about how the United Nations, really the United States pushing the United Nations, accused them of human rights crimes and then referred them to the International Criminal Court. Shortly after that, there was a big battle, quick, big and bloody battle between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Eritrea claims that they were attacked and that a lot of their soldiers were killed. Ethiopia denies it. And around that time, we also got one of our subscribers wrote a note saying, you know, yeah, I hear you. I agree with, you know, with what you're saying about maybe the hypocrisy, but Eritrea really is, really is violating a lot of human rights, which is what we said anyway. Maybe he misunderstood what the point of it was. I think we were talking more about you know, how you define this and why you define it a particular way, because we're not talking about Eritrea and right. Denmark, you know, we're talking about Eritrea and Ethiopia.
And we're talking about the Horn of...
And why is one
yeah,
good?
Yeah, we're talking about the Horn of Africa in general. And Eritrea is being called the North Korea of Africa. And if you look at the countries around Eritrea, I mean, Somalia, Ethiopia, Djibouti, Sudan, there's some very nasty places around there. Life is very rough. And as you say, I didn't, and you didn't mean to imply that Eritrea is a nice country. In fact, Eritrea, as we meant to say, is an example of something that has happened a lot in the past, say, 150 years. The triumph of a revolution that does amazing, heroic things, and then can't really yield once it wins power, so that you end up with a strong man, in this case, Isaias Afwerki, the genius of the Eritrean Revolution, who, if he died at the right moment, could have stayed a hero, but insisted on becoming the strong man. And that there's dozens of countries where that's happened, and it's a dismal outcome. But it's not a uniquely dismal outcome when we're talking about the Horn of Africa.
Right. And to that, I want to just quote one example. This is from the news from a few months ago. The headline is Ethiopia Oromia protests, or Oromia, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, O-R-O-M-I-A. And the headline is hundreds killed, thousands arrested in, quote, brutal crackdown, unquote, Human Rights Watch says. So this is the country, again, that we are allied with, that is basically our proxy military in the Horn of Africa, and whose rival we are now trying to drag into the International Criminal Court for human rights violations, but we're not doing that to Ethiopia. So here's Ethiopia, our friends, the good guys. Ethiopian authorities are allegedly violently quashing protests in this restive Oromia region with near daily accounts of killings and arbitrary arrests, researchers at Human Rights Watch said in a damning report. Activists claim more than 200 people have been killed while thousands remain in detention without charges since November. Security forces have shown no sign of letting up. Things have become considerably more violent in the last few days. So you don't get that No. story out of Eritrea. There are a lot of bad stories you get out of there, but I'm if they were mowing down protesters and detaining them by the thousands or tens of thousands as in Ethiopia, you would certainly hear about it and they would be dragged before the hog for that. So I think so that's one thing I want to say. And the other thing has to do with, well, then why Eritrea? Well, I, you know, go back to 2007. Here's a Reuters article. U.S. considers putting Eritrea on terrorism list. This is August 17th, 2007, and here's the lead. The United States said on Friday it was considering putting Eritrea on its list of state sponsors of terrorism for allegedly funneling weapons to insurgents fighting the Ethiopian-backed government in Somalia. Diplomats say Eritrea and Ethiopia have been waging a proxy war in Somalia since last year when Asmara backed a hardline Islamist movement against the country's government. And that never happened. We kept threatening to put them on a terrorism list. And I don't know why. I mean, I would think that if we had definite evidence and we don't like them, we would have done it. Here's another report from the Long War Journal. I think it's from one of those kind of neocon outfits that sometimes has some good reporting, though. This is 2012. Eritrea, unlisted state sponsor of terrorism. The Long War Journal reports that the Treasury Department has placed sanctions on two Eritrean government officials for supporting al-Shabaab, al-Qaeda's branch in Somalia that is frighteningly effective at recruiting Westerners. These aren't rogue officials.
I don't know about frighteningly effective at recruiting Westerners. Recruiting Somali kids who are part of the diaspora, but they usually have rank and file, which is pretty straightforwardly Somali. That's a strange comment. But yeah, and the claims about mm-hmm. Eritrean support are odd, because the U.S. claims something like they're funding al-Shabaab to the tune of $75,000 a month, which sounds like a lot to you and me, but is a pitifully small amount in the way that money gets passed around to fund proxy armies. And it's also ridiculous to claim that or to imply even that al-Shabaab exists because of Eritrean support. Al-Shabaab is very much a homegrown Somali movement. But it's not impossible that Eritrea is funneling some money and a few weapons to a movement that's giving its enemy some trouble. That would be pretty standard military practice, but they're not the main motive force behind al-Shabaab.
Yeah, given the fact that David Petraeus has been calling, and others from the Carnegie Endowment and so on, have been calling for us to ally with al-Qaeda in Syria, one can imagine that Eritrea might find some reason to maybe fund or funnel some weapons to the al-Qaeda in their neck of the woods. But it sounds a lot like this is the quo pro that pro quo, I'm sorry, that Ethiopia yes. wants from us in return for basically acting as our standing
yes.
army.
Yes,
there.
The Ethiopians have an insane grudge. Well, not insane, but let's say really intense grudge against Eritrea. And as I said last time, one of the interesting things about that is that the currently dominant group in Ethiopia, the Tigray, are related to the dominant group in Eritrea. But the Ethiopian leadership almost seemed to want to prove its Ethiopian credentials by showing their hostility to people of the same ethnic group over the border, by being as anti-Eritrean as they could possibly be. Eritrea also cost Ethiopia, the independence of Eritrea costs Ethiopia its coastline. And that always does a weird thing to countries. You know, there are those rallies in Bolivia every year, which I remember reading about in National Geographic as a clinically depressed kid, where people get together and chant, "Queremos nuestro mar," because Chile took Bolivia's coastline, and that inflicted a deep wound on the country. I mean, there's something about being cut off from the sea that really leaves a grudge, and Ethiopia has that grudge as well against Eritrea.
Mm-hmm. It also turns out that there was the counter narratives are not really allowed in, and I doubt that Eritreans have much of a lobby to push their cause. But there was a report, a Danish report, that came out a few years ago called "Eritrea: Drivers and Root Causes of Emigration." This is another concern. Europeans want to do something to stop the flow of Eritrean refugees and migrants into Europe. I think they're the second largest after Libya from Africa. And so the Danish report concluded that many of the Eritreans fled, many or most, for economic reasons and not because of political repression. And that got slammed and quashed and smeared as very cynical. And it was just because the Danish don't want that, they fudged it all because they want to have a reason to deny refugees, to turn them away from Denmark, which may be true, but it doesn't. But also the report may be true. I mean, they do have major economic problems.
Yeah, I mean, there is not a lot of what Western standard functioning democracy in East Africa, but not all East African states have the same rate of emigration. I mean, Eritrea was a European colony for a long time. Eritreans have a reputation for energy and ambition, and the emigre tradition is pretty strong with them. So it it seems reasonable that they might flee because there's a lot more money in other countries, especially when your country has been ostracized, isolated, and at war for a long time. You're not going to get rich there. And an entrepreneurial people like the Eritreans are going to move to someplace where there's a chance to get rich.
So moving from there to this story, which I find just kind of incredible. So I'll tell you one of the reasons why I find this incredible in a second. But so the headline is massive cyber attack could trigger NATO response. That's what Stoltenberg said. So a major cyber attack could trigger a collective response by NATO. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said in an interview published in Germany's Bild, a severe cyber attack may be classified as a case for the alliance. Then NATO can and must react. How that will depend on the severity of the attack. Now, the problem with this is that it's so hard to identify who actually launches cyber attacks. And we know this, again, first of all, I first became aware of this because in 2007, when in Estonia, when they took down the monument to the Red Army for the victory over the Nazis, Russians, because I think about a quarter or more of the Estonian population is Russian, ethnically Russian or Russian speaking. And this is for them, and they're the underclass there now. And for them, this was sort of the final humiliation. And there were some riots and protests. And then there were basically just DDoS attacks where you turn computers into bots and you bombard servers with so much traffic that they can't really function. It's standard. That happened. People who hated the exile did that to us sometimes and took our servers down. But when that happened in Estonia to a few of their sites for a couple of days, immediately the headlines everywhere, and this was immediately co-opted by people from the cybersecurity part of the defense, military industrial complex, from the defense industry. They said, "Oh my God, this is war. This is cyber war." And it's the first time it's the Russian government. There are people in black coats walking around in rooms with servers and blinking lights, directing these people. We know it's true. And they got, some asshole to say, "Oh yes, we did a forensics on it and it's true," and blah, blah, blah. And then that got conferences immediately set up with all the contractors. And they immediately decide this is the future of warfare and they need to spend billions of dollars on cyber defense. And then it turned out over the weeks and months that followed that, first of all, there was no way at all to pin this on actual Russian government. And that the deeper they looked into it, the more they found out that it was basically for sure. I mean, this were even Estonian, top Estonian officials and Finnish officials. It was nationalist Russian hackers who organized it online. And, they're trying to find some kind of connection where maybe some nationalist within a security service or Kremlin maybe encouraged them. But, if you know about that culture, it's not hard to get them to do that when they're pissed off. And a lot of countries have their nationalist hacker wing. So that's what they found out. So we might have, and at that time, NATO talked about maybe Estonia wanted to maybe invoke Article 5. And you maybe would actually go on war footing. Because some dweebs, in their parents' apartment in Moscow were DDoS attacking a certain, they screwed it up. And this just happened again, two days ago. Big headlines, breaking news. Russian government hackers, that exact line, hacked into the Democratic National Committee, the DNC's servers, and took out, they didn't go for, I don't know, the list of the donors and the email list. So, but they took out the opposition research on Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know how deep you have to dig. Like, the guy is a loon. He makes it pretty public. But in any event, they pulled this out and then a few other things. And it was for sure Washington Post, New York Times, everybody, CNN. For sure, it was Russian government hackers. And that's because, again, some security contractor said, "Oh, we did the forensics on it, and we discovered, that they wore badges, said Russian government on them or whatever. Like, we know for sure." And you can't check this stuff. You can't check it when you're a layperson like us. Well, it's already come out. already. That story, you could tell it was going to fall apart, and it did already fall apart. It wasn't Russian government hackers. It was some hacker called himself Guccifer 2.0 or something. So in theory, what Stoltenberg is saying is we might go to war based on something we have no idea is, you know, is even possible or true. We have no idea. We have no way to check.
Go to war. I mean, are we talking about bombing apartments that you think that these dweebs are broadcasting from? I mean, wouldn't it be better to flood them with internet porn or something? Yeah.
Keep them busy.
Wear them out.
I know. I think what it means is I'm going to whip up some more fear so that we can now devote, you know, another $5 or $10 billion to it's like that quote from Roger Dodger that I put in a few episodes ago. It's what do you do? I make people feel terrible about themselves. Why do you do that? Because then I sell them the product that makes them feel better about themselves.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot. There's quite a parallel between the cosmetics industry and the military industry that way. Yeah. And although, I mean, one thing we know from Terminator 2 is that, you know, you can't bomb Skynet. Skynet is everywhere. I almost remember the speech. It's in dorm rooms. It's in internet cafes. It's every, you know, you can't bomb Skynet, okay? So you're not going to nuke those hackers. It doesn't work that way. It is kind of fun to think about what military strategy you could use that would target the demographic of Russian nationalist dweeb hacker guys. I mean, I would love to get a government grant to, you know, spend a few years researching ways of targeting that particular group.
I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, it's a good question. I mean, actually you could deny porn to them. Or, Jen, I don't know, you could make their ponytails fall out.
I don't know, pretend to be their dream object of desire and then tell them you didn't like them anymore. I don't know. And that the only out was to kill themselves. I gather there are people who do that online, and maybe you could weaponize it. You know, why not? Make a mm-hmm. program that could do that on its own.
They have that too, actually. So they have program. I mean, they have software programs that create dozens and dozens of lifelike avatars for Twitter and Facebook. And then one person can, you know, control them and their responses and so on, the way that they respond and the way that they prey on people is all pre-programmed, but it seems very real. And one person can control like 100 or probably more now, you know, of these avatars. Drive people nuts or keep them busy or whatever, distract them, make them angry, make them do whatever.
Don't we have any patriotic hackers of our own? I mean, I don't know. I assume there's plenty of unemployed, mentally unstable Americans who know how to do this stuff too.
It's funny because patriotism on that level, the real kind of nationalist, you know, crypto fascist patriotism is very anti-government in this country. And, you know, and that's the way our right has developed, unlike in a place like Russia. So, I mean, Edward Snowden, right, who's in Russia, I mean, who was a pretty right-wing guy. I don't think in the current climate, especially, I'm sure the first like 5 years after 9/11,
I think we should make a competition.
I don't really see much of that kind of standard.
And throw it open to our listeners, like invent a weapon that destroys nationalist dweeb hackers. I mean, invent the perfect nonviolent weapon for that threat. We could probably do it a lot cheaper.
Right, and then maybe we can even sell this for a lot of money to NATO. Then it would be nationalist hackers from China and Russia. Those seem to be the two big problems for us. And there are a lot of nationalist hackers in China as well. A lot of them. They're pretty notorious. And they're not controlled by the government usually as well. It's just easier to say that they are controlled by the government. I mean, look, for everybody's purposes out here, it's just easier to say it's the government. You know, it was the government's fault. So moving on to another battle. I think I'll skip. Pakistan has been firing artillery at Afghan forces on the Khyber Pass border. But that's the way it goes out there. I guess
there's this kind of stylized warfare, small scale warfare. It's usually Pakistan, India, but Pakistan, Afghanistan is pretty much inevitable. I mean, there are real wars in both Pakistan and Afghanistan, but this sounds like a show war.
Yeah, or like a negotiation over the border posts and where they're going to be placed. And then on to China, which kind of, I'll just bring this up before we go, because we did a show on the South China Sea, so now we have some context for these stories. This is from yesterday. The headline is U.S. Third Fleet Expands East Asia Role as Tensions Rise with China. In fact, there was another article, I wish I had it up, about our Third Fleet with Japan and India and their new boats all sort of sailing around together in the South China Sea. But here's this story. The U.S. Navy's Third Fleet will send more ships to East Asia to operate outside its normal theater alongside the Japanese-based 7th Fleet, a move that comes at a time of heightened tensions with China. The Third Fleet's Pacific Surface Action Group, which includes the guided missile destroyers USS Spruance and USS Momsen, was deployed to East Asia in April, and more Third Fleet vessels will be deployed in the region in the future. The Philippines, basically we're just going to be sending a lot more ships out there, and when you send a lot of ships out there, it means we need to probably build more ships to put somewhere else where they were before.
Yeah, if you read the cynical blogs inside the U.S. military, they say there's a real push at the higher levels of the U.S. military to pivot away from Middle Eastern counterinsurgency, which is, as I've said before, CDD, cheap, dirty, and dangerous, toward Asia, which will involve lots of sea and air warfare, which is seen by people in the top echelon of the U.S. military as kind of beautiful, clean, and wonderfully expensive. So this pivot back to Asia, back to conventional naval air warfare, has been a U.S. military dream for a really long time. And there's something bizarre about the way the press never seems to tire of reporting these stylized confrontations between U.S. and Chinese ships that never seem to come to anything. The last headline I saw was U.S. vessels shadowed by Chinese cruisers. Well, yeah, you're in the South China Sea. You're facing another country which sees itself as a major power and has put a big investment into its own surface fleet so it can play great power games too. And there are going to be an endless succession of these ballets, little air ballets between U.S. and Chinese planes, little sea ballets between U.S. and Chinese ships. And it seems to go without saying that for the foreseeable future, it's going to come to nothing. It's a way of making these very expensive weapons that big industrialists in China and the United States both happen to make a lot of money off of seem useful and important and active. But the idea that there's going to be some sort of Teddy Roosevelt era naval war between the U.S. and China seems pretty absurd.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the other context, the sort of post-colonial era context, which is that China does not have any internationally recognized claims based on treaties signed when it was at its weakest still. Certainly weakest in the post World War II era, does not have any internationally recognized claims to any Pacific territorial waters, or what were called the EEZ, the economic
exclusion zone,
something zone. I can't even remember the name of it now. Exclusion zone, right, which gives anybody who has that claim recognized by treaty the sole right to exploit resources in a 200-mile radius. China is only recognized EEZ waters are along its coastline, whereas America, there's France alone in the Pacific has like 10 or 20 times the amount of waters under its control. France, you know, America has 10 to 15 times as much as China does. Great Britain has a huge amount. So that's one of the things that's bothering China. And here's an interesting quote from the Chinese foreign ministry in response to this announcement by that we're sending more ships. He said, spokesman for China's foreign ministry said, if U.S. actions had a destructive impact on regional peace and stability in the interest of countries in the region, then China would, quote, definitely be opposed and concerned. And then, quote, how the U.S. military uses its taxpayer dollars to carry out deployments is its own affair, ministry spokesman Liu Kong told the briefing. Quote, I'm not concerned about it. What I'm concerned about is regional peace, security, and stability. This is a nice little swipe at the boondoggle of it all.
Yeah, it's a grandiose boondoggle, and it is trying to maintain, as you said, a colonial legacy where the colonial powers grabbed every island in the world. At the time they grabbed them, the accepted limit of sovereignty was 3 miles, but that changed to 200 miles effectively for a lot of purposes. And that meant that even though those colonial powers like France and Britain had lost a lot of their power, they still had enormous territories that were becoming more valuable as the world got more and more crowded and more hungry every year.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, again, on the other side of this is the fact that a lot of China's neighbors are nervous about China's growing power and do want us in there for different reasons than we want to be there. They want us to be in there to balance things out and give them a good shot at exploiting the resources. You know, now that technology is such that you can extract oil and gas and all kinds of resources and fishing rights, you know, and just to keep China at bay.
Well, that's what Obama was doing, showing his mad chopstick skills in Hanoi with Anthony Bourdain, right? That's there's good reason for all these countries from the Philippines to Vietnam to want a counterbalance to China, and China certainly has a history of domineering over smaller countries on its borders. It's not like China is the good guy here, but it's not like these U.S. military moves have much real military value. They're just a very expensive kind of imperial demonstration.
Yeah, I mean, the question is this what, you know, the 315 million Americans, does this benefit us? Does this make America stronger? Is this really what we need to spend another $100-200 billion on? Or does it just benefit this tiny dynastic contractor aristocracy in the greater Washington, D.C. area that Kelly Vlaus talked about?
I think the answer to that is pretty clear. I mean, most military...
Most military investment is
a way to direct tax money back to the hands of the people who think the money should be theirs in the first place. And it works very well. And when a weapon emerges that is cheap and effective, like the A-10, it gets a lot of hostility from those people. When a weapon is ineffective and extremely expensive, like the F-35, it tends to get a lot of support from the military-industrial complex, to use Eisenhower's term. And it's a good term. It still works. To the point that, you know, as we said when talking to Kelly Vlahos, the Air Force General James Post said that if you support the A-10, the cheap, effective weapon, against the F-35, the expensive, ineffective weapon, "You are committing treason." He actually said that at an Air Force officers meeting. And so we're dealing with a defense department and a defense industry which has nothing to do with defense, or and very little to do with effectively making war.
Yeah, and very little to do with patriotism. It's the patriotism is just exploited to line pockets. And as the feller said, war is a racket, but it happens to be a much more interesting racket, which is why we talk about it, want to hear about it. I mean, the stakes seem higher. It's a more interesting racket than financial rackets, for example, which are really grim, dull, but very effective rackets.
And this war is a racket. Other wars are... I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Is Syria a racket? I couldn't really say. I mean, Syria is a nightmare, but I'm not sure it can be simply called a racket. These imperial wars, they're rackets.
I don't think so.
That's for sure.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, not all wars are rackets. I absolutely agree. And Syria, there's a lot of people trying to turn it into a racket. And for a few people, I mean, for a few groups, I'm sure it is. But in general, no, it's a panic. I mean, it's a horrible, gigantic panic and mess. You know, we never have at all come, and this is really Obama's fault. We've never at all come to terms with the Iraq invasion, with what an unbelievable screw up, you know, epic level murderous screw up that was. And we're still dealing with the consequences, and we don't still grasp it, certainly in this country at least, because Obama came in and just said, you know, let's all get along. Let's forget about the past. Let's heal the divisions.
No.
I mean, that's not how, if you're a lawyer, I mean, I don't know if you're a prosecutor, you don't do that. I mean, you should have kept that thing open and prosecuted it and put people on trial and held hearings and got to the bottom of it. And you know, maybe we'd understand things better. Maybe we would do maybe less stupid things. But, you know, we don't really even grasp what's going on in Syria, because we never at all came to terms with Iraq. Eventually Iraq, you know, in our political culture just became a sort of, one side got to be able to say yeah to the other side. It's pretty much the best you could say about it.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, it's almost comforting in that way to, in spite of the vast sums of money that are being wasted, to think that whatever's going on in the South China Sea is just a racket. It's going to be a lot of expensive, but probably bloodless show business.
One hopes. I mean, that would be pretty crazy, because we would be at a pretty big disadvantage, like it or not, basically we're daring them to scratch our, you know, we're like a mobster who's daring these kids in this neighborhood to key our Lamborghini or something. You know, we're putting these really expensive toys out there in their neighborhood, and if they key any of them and screw them up, then we're going to be really pissed off. But the reality is they could do whatever they want to our ships. They're the land power there, and ships are, as you've written about many times, are very easy to take
out.
There's
just too many ways to take out a ship, and they're overloaded. I mean, they have far too much value, because you can never imagine all the possible threats and all the possible ways a ship can be destroyed. So nothing as big and valuable and stuffed with skilled people as an aircraft carrier should exist, even if you think you can defend it. And there really isn't a way to defend it. I mean, China has ICBMs, which can be nuclear armed and detonated over a carrier group miles above the surface. If this ever came to a real war in the all-out World War II style that people imagine, those carrier groups would cease to exist. There's no way they could be defended. But they're so much a part of American military culture and of this whole ballet that's going on that they can't be abandoned. So either they exist as part of the ballet, or they exist to get a lot of people killed in a horrible way.
Okay, and on that happy note again, we will close out the show.
It's wonderful how we always end on a happy note.
This was... I know. It's almost like we're two depressed people or something, you know. So, all right. So this is was episode 38 of Radio Warnerd. And thank you again to everybody and to our subscribers. We're getting close to 1,000 subscribers. We might be able to launch a coup on a small-sized country pretty soon with this Radio Warnerd Legion.
We should have a country.
We're getting there.
Competition.
Yes. And okay. Thank you, John, and good luck out there in the monsoon. Stay dry.
Yeah, it's more the motorbikes that scare me. Actually, somebody told me how to avoid the traffic in Phnom Penh. Cars are stupid. The motorbikes can swerve around you, but a car is stupid. So, and of course, there's that rule here that applies everywhere in the world I've ever been. A Lexus SUV has virtually no traffic laws that apply to it. And a Lexus SUV with blacked out windows, including the windshield, has no laws at all that apply to it.
It's like Death Race 2000. Yeah, I remember in Hanoi, it was a weird thing. It was very School of Fish, almost like wading through the traffic in these really busy streets where everybody was on a little moped or cheap sort of motorized bicycle. But you would never get hit when you cross the streets or walking. Yeah. It was almost kind of fun. It was almost like swimming with the tide or swimming against the tide. Everyone was really good. But a car, yeah, those are the different people. And they, if it's anything like what I've seen in some other former communist countries, people who get nice cars really want to show how much they despise and hold in contempt the non-car public, you know.
Yeah,
violently.
Yeah, and they will.
Yeah.
And that, yeah.
So
you learn to avoid different things with different intensity. You learn to avoid. Yeah, seriously. I've learned just in a few weeks here that you do not ever get in the way of a Lexus SUV with blacked out windows. Here's you know, never say we didn't give you any practical tips. If you're in Southeast Asia, stay away from those blacked out Lexus SUVs.
Just think of them as like Mako sharks or something, you know. All right, good. So thanks again, and we'll talk next week. And thank you again to everybody. And bye bye, John.
used to try so hard to get back on my feet. But now I'm safe, because you took me off the street. No more tears of sorrow and getting wasted before bedtime comes each night. We just celebrate each minute by keeping rats where they belong.
Okay, and that song that we just played is Sanctuary by Alexander Hacke, who was in the band Eisterzind and Neubauten, if you remember them, the German industrial punk band that kind of started the whole industrial music revolution. And the other song that was just after we spoke to Gunnar Jonsson is by the band Dubiosa Collective, I think they're called, and the song was called USA. And both of those songs come courtesy of the excellent Cool Arrow Records. And my friend Billy Gould, who runs Cool Arrow Records, an amazing indie record company, KOOLARROW.com is where you'll find their records. And both of those bands are on Cool Arrow Records. They also have great Russian punk. They have some of the most amazing Mexican metal and Mexican hip hop you'll ever hear. So big thanks and big shout out to Cool Arrow Records. Thanks for donating those songs. And a big thank you to our man, Greg Conger, who gave us our Radio Warnerd intro and extra. So thank you all again, and see you next week.